This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Ladies and gents, John Mattis here, host of the Off the Post podcast. A quick message off the top. I just want to remind people to subscribe on iTunes, to rate this podcast on iTunes, to review on iTunes. It helps me, the host, the producer, the editor of this podcast. It makes my bosses happy and moves me up the iTunes rankings. And we're also on Google Play, Stitcher, SoundCloud, you name it. So, again, Off the Post, you just have to search that on anything and you'll find us. Including this episode, we are already 9 episodes into season 2. So, full steam ahead, and I promise bigger and better things. I got Kelly Rudy coming on next week. Someone from the Vegas Golden Knights front office in the near future. And, you know, the regular guests of Michael Tracos, Matthew Collar, Travis Yost, that crew will continue to come on, and it's a revolving door. And if you guys have any ideas for guests, feel free to message me on Twitter. I'm at MattisJohn. That's MATISZ JOHN. Or if you're into emailing, JMATISZ at postmedia.com. All right, on to the episode. This was recorded Friday. It was with Lance Hornby of the Toronto Sun, a long time Toronto Maple Leafs beat writer. He has a new book coming out. And also, guess what? The Leafs are actually good.
From the center of the hockey universe, this is the Off the Post podcast.
Lance Hornby of the Toronto Sun, welcome to Off the Post. What is new?
How you doing? Thank you for having me. The Leafs are 6-1. I've got a new book out, Toronto and the Maple Leafs, and things are good. It's very interesting down at the rink, and book sales are doing well, and I think the whole city seems to be pumped about the team. And
hold on, are you trying to get out of here in a minute or
no. It's been a wonderful October so far in terms of good stories to write, and I've been around long enough to know that it doesn't last. And even though the Leafs are second place overall now, I believe as of today, yeah. I think there's going to be some rocky roads ahead. But finally, this team I think has what it takes to deal with the pressures not only in the NHL but of playing in Toronto.
Yeah, you've covered the team for 3 decades.
And none of them a Stanley Cup winner, in case anyone
knows. No, not even close. I guess 93 is close. But is this the best collection of talent that you've seen? Or potential, I guess, would be probably a better word.
I guess the big thing is when the Leafs were considered to be strong contenders in the past, like post 1967, there wasn't much of a building mode to it. It happened, I won't say by accident, but they tended to be one-year wonders. When Pat Burns came in, for example, in 92-93, they hadn't made the playoffs in a couple of years. People would have been very happy that year if they just made it close, or maybe won one round against Detroit. But they went within one game of going to the Cup final. And that set the bar really high, and I think that made it difficult for the years after, because there was all of a sudden a different expectation on the team. Same sort of thing with Pat Quinn. He came in 1998. The team had missed the playoffs a couple of years. Again, people would have been happy with just some signs of a turnaround. That team also got very close to going to the Stanley Cup final, although it did remain competitive for the next few years. But in each time, it was always a veteran team that always seemed to be that one player away, that big deal at the end. And what they wound up doing, unfortunately, was selling the farm many times to get the deals for Brian Leetch, for Glenn Wesley. Noble efforts, and Toronto teams before hadn't done that because they've been, for various reasons. But it really hurt the draft cupboard going through. And that led, I think, to the past decade or so when they were, didn't have a lot of players to fall back on. Now I think, they've finally taken advantage of the fact that Toronto, the fan base that is, will wait for a rebuild, and they've done it the right way. It's stripped it down, and things have gone their way. The lottery balls fell their way for Austin Matthews. They had William Nylander and Mitch Marner, two really good players. And so you don't have that mentality that they're one player, away. I think they may have the franchise player they need. Now they have the goaltending. All of a sudden now I think you're seeing a team that's prepared not just for a short playoff run, but as the Shanna plan, as people want to call it, it's ready for 4 or 5 years of contention. And in the salary cap era, we know how difficult that is.
Yeah, and I guess the underlying theme with this team is that they have a special period here where Matthews, Marner, and Nylander are making less than $1 million.
Yes.
So there's a lot of cap flexibility, and that helped them get Patrick Marleau. And you would think at the deadline, assuming that they're still one of the better teams in the league, that they would pursue some missing piece element. So, this doesn't happen often where everything goes according to plan, essentially, yes. Right? They draft, they develop. Nylander was a great pick in hindsight, right? Matthews, obviously, they were going to pick, and he's turned out to be better than anyone expected. But, Nylander might be the guy where you go, wow, they really hit on that pick. And then they sign guys like Callie Rosen. They sign guys like Nikita Zaitsev. Like, they've gone out of their way to support Austin Matthews and some of the veterans that are holdovers from the previous regime. Yeah. Like, that, I just feel like almost everything has gone well. And I know at the start of last year, a lot of the talk was, okay, the easy part is done. You drafted your players, the easy ones, the Austin Matthews, the Mitch Marners, where it's like you have maybe one or two decisions to make there, but you choose sort of the easiest one and it works out. But the hard part is always putting it together, like going out and actually winning games. And last year they did it to an extent, but this year, 7 games in, they look like just a more complete team.
Yeah. Well, I think the big thing is they don't have to rely on one player. I mean, when Nylander came in a couple of years ago, under the old sort of Toronto approach, I guess a great example of that might be Nazem Kadri. Kadri came in, they hadn't had a decent first rounder in a while, and the pressure was squarely on him. And, I don't think he was ready for it, even though thank goodness he's a great quote and everything. He's very comfortable in front of the cameras. But I don't think the team was comfortable with him having all this attention on him because he was considered not the savior, but he was just unique, a first rounder who'd come in and made an impact. Then comes Nylander, and I have to wonder, knowing Nylander's sort of shy attitude, how well he would have held up getting the attention that some other first rounders have picked up. But to your point, they have a lot of these players, and the attention is being passed around. So you don't have the pressure on that one player. And I guess I'll link to this whole talk about Austin Matthews being captain. Well, they don't need Austin Matthews to be a captain right now. I think he's developing fine. He doesn't need that distraction. Right now that's taken up by the attention on the other young rookies and the veterans in the room. And I think, that's another reason they're off to a decent start, is that there isn't, there's a lot of a lot of players who can take up all that attention and take up all those roles on the ice as well.
Well, and I'm always hesitant to give teams too much credit when they come out flying out of the gate, but this team has looked good for the most part, at least through 7 games, like shift by shift. You can see that this is a good hockey team. Mm-hmm. It's not like they're scoring these fluky goals or they're getting outshot by a wide margin. Like, they look like a top tier team, and I think something that's flown under the radar a bit is the fact that before these young guys were there, guys like Tyler Bozak, James Van Riemsdyk, Nazem Kadri to an extent, they were relied upon to play heavy minutes, to play a lot of minutes, and it just didn't suit their playing styles. It didn't suit how they should really fit into a team. And now they're, I don't want to call them complementary players, but they're secondary players, secondary options, at least in the grand scheme of things. And I think that just makes more sense to to the way that they fit into the NHL. Yeah. Like, Tyler Bozak shouldn't be a first line center. And for like years, it was like, is it Bozak or is it Kadri? Who is the number one center? And really, it didn't matter. But that was like a big topic of discussion. And now it's like, they're both perfectly fine as the 2 and 3 because, you know, they're getting very similar minutes. And it's just, it's a credit to the rebuild and the way that it's all shaken out that they're able to kind of hang out in the background a bit and still produce.
Our colleague Steve Simmons made his career on saying Tyler Bozak was not a first line center. So, you know, he used to put that in his Sunday notes all the time, comparing him, you know, to his ice time and his shots on goal and his possession and all that sort of thing. But it's a good point. I mean, you didn't have to be a coaching genius to check the Leafs in those days. You had Tyler Bozak, you know, Kadri to a certain extent coming up behind him, and Harry Lick and Dewey or whoever come and play in on the third and fourth lines. But now you've got it all. You've got it all spread out. You have a way to, I guess, distribute the scoring. And your point is a good one, that rather than fading into the past, into the sunset, Bozak and Van Riemsdyk are complementary. I thought last year when Marner came along, Marner was as much a push for them as they were for Marner in his rookie year. And you look at Bozak and Van Riemsdyk now, you know, contributing offensively. It's another thing, of course, what's going to happen with Van Riemsdyk at the end of the year. Maybe we'll get into that later. But what a contribution Bozak has made, I think, over the years. Good face-off guy, decent team guy. I think he's off the ice too. He's matured now. He's a father. He's pushing 30. I think last year they had to have a special cushion for him on the bench because he had a lower back issue. But I think he's really made a contribution to this team, where he and Van Riemsdyk before, they were sort of Phil Kessel's sidekicks.
Right.
And he used to sit there and giggle in the dressing room when Kessel would run from the media, and rather than stepping in and say, Phil, sit in your stall, talk to the media, don't be disappearing for a month like he did. Now I think they're taking that leadership role in the room, and I think that's been missed. And you've added guys like Hainsey and Marlowe to that, but I think having players around who've done the Toronto thing for 6 or 7 years, like JVR and Bozak has, that's a big boost to this team.
Well, and one of the benefits of covering the team for as long as you have is that you see guys start out as rookies, and then, like with Bozak, who's, I believe, the longest tenure Leaf at this point, you see him now as a 30-year-old or 29, whatever he is.
Yes.
And, he's a full adult now. Like you said, he has a kid. Mm-hmm. Like, you sort of see him evolve as a person, and then also on the ice, where it's like maybe there's certain parts of their game that they just polish over the years, and obviously...
Well, with him, it's face-offs, for sure.
Yeah, so... Like, it kind of comes back to the fact that this team was so kind of bare bones even a couple of years ago, and now it's just flush, especially up front. Like, I was thinking about it the other day, and I looked around the league. Like, it's probably the deepest forward group in the league.
You can
make a few other arguments, but from 1 to 9, I think it's probably the deepest.
Well, one guy's name we have not mentioned yet, who's responsible for a lot of this, is Mike Babcock.
Yeah.
And he was able to, very demanding coach, of course, and his assistants are just as tough as he is on this team. But I think he's been able to put together a really good game plan in. I think everybody knows what their job is. Those who couldn't play ball went by the wayside. I'm talking about, the string of fourth liners, say the Peter Hollins or people like that. If you weren't on board, you were gone. So I think that's a credit to him as well. It's a deep forward line. I think... I guess maybe the fourth line, any team. With
That's why I mentioned more the top nine.
But look what they've done. Eric Ferrer was considered to be on the scrap heap. Came back. He's making a push, challenging Dominic Moore for ice time. And if you can't do any worse than, say, Connor Brown or Kasperi Kapanen or now Mitch Marner for the immediate future as your fourth line winger, then that's still pretty good considering what everybody else has.
Yeah, Connor Brown would probably be on the second or third line on most teams, I would think.
Yeah. And there's a guy who's been, again, a Toronto guy, rewarded for hard work, OHL MVP, but he was a kid, you know, not picked very high, not highly thought of. He fought for everything he got, and there's a lot of that in some of the other Leafs on the team. Like Kadri, I think, is also mature. He obviously had some adjustment difficulties on and off the ice. Mm-hmm. Now suddenly you see him kind of rounding out to be a you know, a full-time guy. I remember last year talking to him at the summer skates when Matthews hadn't arrived yet.
Yeah.
He said, I think I could be a positive influence on Austin Matthews. I think I could teach him about, and you know, maybe even I might have chuckled a bit inside, and certainly people said, what's this guy talking about,
right?
You know, with your kind of checkered career. But you know what, he's on and off the ice, I think he's made more contributions than people thought.
Yeah, 30 goal scorer. With JVR, Bozak, and Komarov, who do you think fits into the future? Because all of them are on expiring contracts, and let's face it, they would probably have to take a hometown discount if they want to fit here long term. Mm-hmm. Do you have any feeling for what the organization thinks, or maybe your own opinion on those three guys?
My first opinion is that I can't believe how Toronto fans who've waited so long for winter are now suddenly fixated. What are we going to do?
Yeah.
You know, 2 or 3 years from now, you know, like even last year it was this, you know, how are they going to, you know, it was already, as soon as Matthews got to 20 or 30 goals, how are we going to afford him 3 or 4 years
yeah.
down the road? You know what, so it's just a personal thing, but, you know, let the year unfold.
Nobody like enjoy knows, the moment sort of thing?
Enjoy the moment. Yeah. Nobody knows what's going to happen. Injuries could pop. Last year they were blessed as a team with injuries, and they got through that, and nobody expected them to do as well as they did. You know, it is a salary cap era, though. I understand that. And certainly that puts pressure on a guy like Van Riemsdyk. So to answer your question, I think JVR as the potential highest earner of the group would be the person that maybe you think about dealing towards the end of the year, depending on where the team is too. Let's remember, this time last year, if you know, everyone would have thought that you know, the Leafs will probably be out of it. They won't be in the playoffs.
Yeah.
And Austin Matthews included. You know, no one thought they'd do as well as they did. And maybe you moved JVR at that time.
Yeah.
Now I think he's you know, he'd be an attractive rent-a-player coming to the end of his deal. But people also need depth at center, which would make Bozak a potential guy. Again, if you want to get that far. But you know, they play 82 games for a reason. Get there first and see where they are. I mean, I'm not saying this team could win a cup this year, but right now, as you say, they're the East is a bit more wide open now than maybe people thought, with the Rangers and Canadiens falling back a bit. So you can't really take the Leafs out of the possibility of at least winning the East. Maybe whoever comes out of the East will get killed by the Western champ again. But, you know, I would say let it roll and see what happens. But JVR, I guess, in the $6 million range for next year wouldn't fit if you have to start thinking about how you're going to pay all those young kids when their entry-level deals come up.
If you're JVR, though, I mean, you've been with a team for a while here. You've seen the ups and downs, not to the extent of Bozak, but close. And now you have this special group.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if hometown discount is at least on his mind. I realize that you know, money is important, especially for these guys' future, setting themselves up for the rest of their life. So a couple million here, a couple million there is very important. But, I mean, if the guy wants to win a cup, how many how many other markets are going to provide the potential of doing that at this point, right?
Yeah. Well, you know what? JVR is an interesting thing. I think he's made you know, a commitment to the team over the years. I think the Leafs definitely got the better of that deal in the Shen trade.
Yes.
With, you know.
I think that's fair to say.
Yes. So he's made an investment, emotional, team-wise, otherwise financially, in this town. So I would think, you know, that would cross his mind.
Yeah.
However, I don't know if, let's say, New Jersey comes to him. New Jersey, of course, not being far from his birthplace.
Fair.
You know, if they came and said, if they're a contending team and said, you know what, we'd like you to have a shot here, or one of the Western teams, you know, that Stanley Cup is something you can't, you know, you can't really, the lure of the Cup is something you can't discount in a player's mind. You know,
no.
I mean, that's what kind of got Matt Sundin, who thought he was going to stay here forever. That was, the lure took him away. The lure took a lot of other players away. And as nice as it would be to say, you know, I played in Toronto for X number of years. If James Van Riemsdyk, for example, says, you know, when I'm 50, I want to be looking at the mantle at my miniature Stanley Cup, then that is going to take precedence, I think.
All right, before we talk about your book, I want to touch on Austin Matthews and the player that he's already developed into. Like, he's a special kind of player in the sense that there don't seem to be any glaring weaknesses. he has this deceptive shot that's been talked about a lot lately because of the goals he's scoring in the early part of the season, where he's using defensemen as screens. He's toe dragging on almost every shot. He's shooting very close to the net, so that obviously increases chance of scoring. You know, he's super good at puck retrieval, stealing pucks. Like, you go down the list and you're like, this guy just seems to have such a high ceiling. And if I'm a Leafs fan, the one thing that I'm especially excited about is that this guy seems like there's ice in his veins, right? It seems like there's no sort of like nerves. There's no underlying like vulnerability. I mean, obviously, yeah, like inside he's probably, but yeah, he's not showing, yeah, anything, right? It's like, yeah, it's like he goes out there, scores four goals or you know, 4 points, and after he just shrugs. He's like, whatever.
He's a very interesting guy, and I guess maybe I'll compare it to two other players,
sure,
whom he is often compared to. That would be Jack Eichel and Connor McDavid. Now, Eichel, from what I can gather, is, you know, his, obviously the start to his career, hurt a little bit by injuries, but he is, you know, I don't know the word for it, he doesn't seem to be adjusting as well off the ice anyway to the attention he's getting. Connor McDavid, the first year and leading up to the draft, I thought he was kind of aloof. I wondered how he would, you know, how he would adapt. I think he's done much more, you know, since, especially with everything foisted upon him, the pressure, the early season injury. I'm really impressed by the young man he's turned out to be. But also the thing in Edmonton is he's the only game in town. There's a lot of pressure on that guy, especially after making him captain. And I guess maybe that goes back to our point about not giving Matthews that extra load if he doesn't need it at this stage. So, you know, Matthews, you're right. I think he, you know, he comes from a non-hockey area. He learned hockey in a non-traditional way, playing on the, you know, on the half rink and kind of learning how to stick handle in a phone booth. His father was a college pitcher. He, you know, before Matthews took up hockey as his great passion in life, he was a baseball player. And so his father, being a pitcher, would throw him all kinds of junk ball, and that
kind of helps with the hand eye.
Matthews learned how to hit the screwball, the knuckler, the curve, and that's why he's so good at knocking pucks out of the air and all that kind of thing. So I think in this Mike Babcock, in this, as part of this Shannon plan thing, you know, and having the different background, playing over in Europe for a year in Switzerland, and having his family over there, and working under a coach such as Mark Crawford, whom I had the pleasure of sharing a plane trip from Vancouver to Toronto just before Matthews was drafted. And he was telling me, everything he told me about Matthews has turned out to be true. This guy can fire from anywhere. He loves to use the defenseman as a screen. All the things you mentioned, he said, to watch for. And he said, if it wasn't for that few days difference in the draft, he would be in the conversation with you know, with McDavid and Eichel in their draft years. So I really like how Matthews has developed. Who knows what two or three more years of being the guy in Toronto will be, you know, will affect him. You could already see it. His massive scrums at the end of the day at practice or during a game.
He seems a bit annoyed by it.
He does, I think.
But, and I probably would be too, to be honest.
Yeah. But you know what? You're going to eventually make a pretty good living at, you know, $9, $10 million for that. It's 5 minutes out of your day. So, you know, get used to it. And I'd like to think on behalf of all our media colleagues, we're not, you know, again, we only need him for a few minutes a day, and they're not stupid questions. And a lot of the people in that scrum are from Leafs TV, from the NHL Network. They're essentially adding to the, you know, it's not a paparazzi mentality.
Yeah.
It's their own people who often put these media demands on them. But again, 5 minutes out of a 24-hour day, as Doug Gilmore used to say, and he was as followed as any Maple Leaf was in the busy, busy years, you know, is not a lot to ask of a player.
Do you think Matthews is the surefire captain, or do you think Morgan Rielly is at least in the conversation? Because before Matthews came here, people were thinking, you know, give Rielly a year or two and they'll slap a C on him.
Well, they said that about Luke Shen too. Although I must say,
second Luke Shen reference.
I must say, Captain Morgan has a great ring to it.
It does. It does.
All you drinkers out there, but he's a you know what he. Now, there's a guy who's very relaxed in front of the camera, very good jokes and all that kind of thing. And I don't know if making him captain would necessarily change all that on him. But I think, you know, I was discussing this the other day with somebody, being a captain in the NHL, very, very overrated. I think, you know, it's great in a place like Toronto. And I used to think when I was younger, too, that, you know, how could you not want to take the job that George Armstrong or Dave Keon had, or the way that, you know, Doug Gilmore and Wendell Clark conducted themselves. And Matt Sundin, I guess, was probably the most diplomatic Leaf captain of all. But, you know, Sundin's role in that room was enhanced behind closed doors by his lieutenants, the Ty Domies, the Gary Roberts, those guys. So I think the position of a captain, you know, is kind of overrated. And I think it's, you know, something the Leafs don't necessarily need at this point. You'd love to have a Jonathan Toews come in and take charge, or a Ray Bourque, or, you know, have a Mark Messier who came off the ice and any laggard he just grabbed and throw against the wall and, you know, say sharpen up, that kind of thing. That's great to have. But if that's not in Matthew's DNA, why force it on him?
Right. Okay. Lance, let's talk about your book.
Oh, yeah. Oh, we happen to have one right here.
Yeah, exactly. How convenient.
Yes.
Toronto and the Maple Leafs, a city and its team. Tell me about it.
Well, this isn't so much on ice stuff. I mean, I didn't want to go where many others, including myself, have gone, you know, talking about whatever 1967 ad nauseum. This is the relationship Toronto has with its fans. And this is something that goes back to the Irish immigrants who came in the middle 1800s from the potato famine. They came over here, it's cold weather, everything's frozen. You know, they adopted a form of hurling on ice as their, as one of their big, you know, sports. They wanted to meld in, and that's really gone right through many ethnic groups who've come to Toronto since then. You know, the cold winter weather will bind us together, and as the song goes, and a lot of people in different backgrounds from the British Isles, and then going right through World War II and the post, you know, the post-immigration years, the Italians, Portuguese, you know, Asian, all the different countries who've come here, they've you know, they've looked for a way to meld in with Toronto. And I think it was Mark Osborne, I think, and Peter Zezel who were telling me once they were big in the creation of the Canadian Multicultural Hockey League. And they said they would look at all the fans at Maple Leaf Garden, see all different faces from all different races. And it made them think that Toronto is a different market. Now, certainly, you know, haven't won a cup in many, many years. But I think more than, say, Montreal or the New York Rangers or any other Original Six team, Toronto has the hockey team and the citizens are much, much closer because of everything that happened off the ice.
So a lot of it's based on the cultural significance thing of the team and the way that Toronto's changed over the years as a city?
Yes. And another thing is this. Radio, the medium itself, sports on radio, happened a lot with Foster Hewitt. He was the first one to go on the air. He was the first one to tell people about this wonderful far-off place named Maple Leaf Gardens. And on cold prairie nights, you know, not to get too soppy here, but you know what? They were the only game in town. The Montreal Canadiens had Quebec and a selection of Eastern Canada. Foster Hewitt was the first guy to go across the country with his broadcast. And he was very, very influential. I think in World War II, when there was a shortage of binoculars, when people thought there was going to be a West Coast invasion, he happened to mention it on the air that, you know, if you have any spare binoculars, please send them, you know, to your local civil defense association. They were just inundated with all kinds of binoculars. And he had to say, okay, stop, we've got enough, thank you very much. And when they were building Maple Leaf Gardens, he said, if you want to find out about this, if you want to be not an investor in Maple Leaf Gardens, but want to find out more about this, remember, it's the middle of the Great Depression.
Right.
Everybody wanted the Leafs to play in a new rink. He said, send a dime in an envelope, and you'll get a prospectus about what this new rink. And they were just inundated with letters, snail mail in those days.
Yeah, of course.
With a little dime in there to get your to find out about Maple Leaf Gardens. But during the war, the Leafs were so intrinsic in the community fabric that the government would put all their major announcements about whatever, this battle, that battle, you know, this shortage, that shortage, or whatever was going on, put it on the Leaf games because they knew everybody was gathered around to listen to Foster Hewitt. So that's the kind of effect that they had.
So those are the type of stories that you tell in this book.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, you know, the thing too is that Toronto, once upon a time, was a championship city that won five cups in the 40s and, of course, four in the 1960s. And that brought people together. That was a big, you know, all those players and all the cultural things that we had, the Leaf calendars, Hockey Night in Canada, you know, all the famous writers and broadcasters, and a lot of that all came out of the Leafs winning. And when they haven't won for 50 years, sometimes those are the tales that are passed down from grandfather to father to sun. And when you go to Western Canada, it's quite amazing. You'll see all these kids like your age,
yeah.
and have, who've liked, you know, who have Leaf sweaters on. You think, right. wait a minute, you're doing that in Edmonton. And now you've seen Wayne Gretzky in Calgary, you've seen the Stanley Cup in Vancouver, you've seen the Sedins, and yet you're that age and you still have a Leaf sweater. Why? It's because my father and my grandfather yep. listened to Foster Hewitt way back when.
Well, that's the thing about Leafs fans is that they're, I mean, this isn't a scientific thing, but anecdotally, it seems like they travel across the country better than any other team. Maybe the Habs more because of the yeah. French connection. So if you're French in, mm-hmm. in whatever province, you might yeah. be drawn to them. But, you know, Leafs compared to the Senators, like the Senators don't travel well in regards to their fans yeah. spreading out. Like the Oilers, maybe a bit because they won so many cups. But the Leafs are in sort of their own tier of dominating the country.
Yeah, you just go. You see it somewhat on TV, but now everywhere you go on the road, Matthews jerseys everywhere. Right? It's kind of. I guess I would compare it to the Chicago Cubs in that they're everywhere. And part of, in the book, actually, I talked to the president of the Cubs
fan club. Interesting.
And I, you know, I was doing the story at that time. The Leafs had gone 47 years without a cup. The Cubs hadn't won, of course. They were coming up on their 100th anniversary of not winning a World Series. And the gentleman said, "Okay, yeah, sounds like a good story. Go ahead." He said, "How long have the Leafs not won a cup?" I said, "47 years." He said, "47 years? We eat that for breakfast in Chicago. Oh my God! Try going 102 years without winning." But I don't think it'll be that long.
Well, that's the thing, and. You're releasing this book at a good time. A lot of people are interested in the Leafs right now for obvious reasons.
Yes.
And, you know, the history is important to this team. You see it see it in the way that they salute military, that they...
Yeah, so they're a military team. They had a, you know, the Conn Smythe, their founder, was a military guy. Chris Hadfield, the astronaut, his grandfather was an Army officer and their first physical education.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, their first... guy to adopt physical regimens, like in the Army, to try and improve them that way. A few members of the Leafs family were lost in World War II. The big thing was there's another story in there about the Lancaster bomber. They were under radio silence over Germany, and they would just pass the time through the intercom. The pilot did a great Foster Hewitt imitation, so he would do this.
Wow.
He would imitate games to the point where people. You know, the bombardier and the co-pilot were arguing over whether the play was offside because he did such a good, you know, he shoots, he scores.
That's amazing.
Kind of thing. Yeah, and it goes right up. I was lucky enough to go to Afghanistan in 2008 with the Leaf alumni, and the sight of kids with flip-flops, shorts, an M16 over their shoulder and a Daryl Sittler sweater walking around the base at Kandahar. That was really tells you how far the Maple Leaf reach goes.
No kidding. How long does this take to put together? Because one, you know, you're covering a wide range of topics, over all these different years. And two, you're talking to all these people that are probably hard to track down or they're not alive still.
Well, I would say it's 33% stuff I'd written already that I updated, 33% of things that I'd done and hadn't written yet. I'd sort of sat around waiting for the...
Kind of banked.
Yeah, banked. 33% is new interviews. People with like John Tory, the mayor.
Cool.
Yeah, and Tory has a connection going way, way back to the original gardens. Who else they speak to? A guy who does funeral arrangements that are Leaf themed.
Huh.
As the dearly departed leaves, he's got the Hockey Night in Canada theme going, and Paul Bear is dressed in away Maple Leaf sweaters. I took note that the funeral I did see had these six guys with black mourning jackets and away Maple Leaf sweaters because their dear friend had been with them for a long time. They probably saw many Saturday night games together. Sports psychologists, I talked to Gordy Stellick in the early days of. Of sports radio just a wide range of people who all have, you know, something about that amazing connection with the Leafs. Births, deaths, marriages, architecture, women's rights. You would be amazed at how the Maple Leafs have sort of touched all those places.
And before you let everyone know how they can find the book, how they can purchase it, let's talk about Maple Leaf Gardens for a second, because I actually live like almost next door to it, mm-hmm. but now it's a Loblaws, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I'm young enough to know, I never went to a game there or anything, but I watched games on TV when they were playing there. But like, I can't really wrap my head around sort of the legacy, even though I walk, I literally am in the building like once a week.
It was the largest indoor gathering place in Canada for three or four decades. Everything happened there. It wasn't just the Leafs, politics. They had war maneuvers there. They had great boxing matches. Everybody knows about the wrestling. The Toronto Marlies. It was Canada's first multi-use building, and they invented so many things. The score clock was invented there. The red light, the red goal light, separate penalty boxes. It was a site of major innovations in hockey, and of course, everyone identified with it as a place on Hockey Night in Canada.
Yes.
You know, that little, the perfect little theater, as my friend John Shannon calls it. You know, you could get up and see the guy get up right behind the Leaf bench and have to pass behind Pat Burns to go to the washroom. Little things like that. And yet the Hockey Night studio there was not much bigger than the little place we're in right now. It was a magical place. And again, even though the Leafs didn't win a lot of Stanley Cups, it was home to many people. And I had great interviews with Paul Morris, of course, the voice of Maple Leaf Gardens. Showed up one day for work when he was there. His father was actually the superintendent.
Okay.
But one night, started the 64 season, I think, the original PA guy, Red Barber, didn't show up for whatever reason. Paul went behind the mic. He never left it. He didn't miss a Leaf game from 63 until the second game of the Air Canada Centre.
Wow.
Because he went in there and wanted to see, you know, he wanted to be the link to the next one. But over, whatever, something like 100 years, the Maple Leafs have only had, since 1927, I guess, have only had three or four guys be their PA announcer. Red Barber, Paul Morris, Andy Frost, and Mike Ross, the current guy. So it's a long legacy.
See, these are the type of things that you know that I don't know at all. Like your knowledge of the Leafs is pretty extensive.
Well, I jammed as much as I could into the book, so I hope people enjoy it.
Yeah, where can they find it?
Bitter Bookstores, as they say. It's published by ECW. A wonderful forward by Ron Ellis, the last Maple Leaf, a member of the last Leaf Stanley Cup team and Team Canada 72 as well.
That's a good link.
You can get it on Amazon as well, and it's got a great reception. It's kind of like my White Album, I guess you could say. I tried to put a little bit of everything in there, so I hope people enjoy it as much as I did writing it.
Okay, Lance, thanks for coming in and talking Leafs, talking your book.
Thanks for having me on, John.